If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, I'm Dave Musgrave, and this is the second History Extra podcast for the month of June 2012. Coming up in this week's episode, we have...
It's often said one of the distinctive features of Scottish soldiering is the, how much they write about it as much as the fighting.
That was Edward Spears on the military side of Scottish history.
The cause of Queen Caroline becomes a huge popular campaign around which everybody rallies.
And that was Malcolm Chase on the events of the year 1820. The podcast is brought to you from the team behind BBC History Magazine, which is Britain's best-selling history magazine. If you haven't read it, you really ought to. You can find it in all good newsagents and on subscription, and there are details of the latest issue and subscription deals on our website, which is historyextra.com. You can also find us digitally. We have a Kindle edition, which is available direct from the Amazon website, and an iPad edition, which is available from the Apple newsstand. Also, if you want breaking historical news, you can find us on social media, facebook.com/historyextra and twitter.com/historyextra. Edward Spears, Professor of Strategic Studies at the University of Leeds, is co-editor of a new volume called A Military History of Scotland. I caught up with him to talk about the martial aspect of Scotland's stories. You've co-edited A Military History of Scotland. So the obvious first question is, is military history a particularly important theme in Scottish history?
Military history is certainly a crucial theme in Scottish history. Tom Devine once said that the Scots were born fighting. A whole part of Scottish independence, Scottish identity, was carved out of war and was sustained by war over a long period of time. And indeed, much of Scottish identity, even since the Acts of Union and of Parliament, has reflected the successes and achievements of her military forces.
Okay, so does that mean that its military history is more important to Scotland than to other nations of the UK?
I think it's peculiarly important to Scots. For many centuries, it had a profound effect on both the forging of Scotland as a kingdom, both internally and protecting it externally, and thereby securing its identity. If you think of other parts of the United Kingdom, Wales, for example, the conquest was over relatively quickly. Ireland, very different kettle of fish, also has a strong military tradition as well, and I've written chapters on that. So both those Celtic regions, somewhat different from Wales, very much forged in war and affected by war.
So where are the origins of this fighting spirit amongst the Scots then?
Well, I think the Scottish ways of warfare have been those of a small country adapting to its own circumstances and trying to develop a distinctive way of warfare. In many respects, this relied in the medieval period on cross-border raids, actually on battle avoidance rather than fighting battles. Bannockburn was an exception rather than the rule. A lot of guerrilla warfare, some combined castle and seaborne warfare in the Western Isles, very, very distinctive form of warfare there. A reliance in Scotland upon readiness to trade territory for time. When it comes to facing major invasions, scorched earth policies, putting major socio-economic sacrifices, particularly in the borders and the Lothian regions, for the sake of, if not defeating an enemy, at least holding it at bay for long enough for it to become distracted and go elsewhere. So Scotland's had a long record of dealing with invaders from the Romans right through to Oliver Cromwell.
And is that the very fact they've been faced by invaders and attackers for two millennia, is that part of the reason why they have this martial spirit then? Is that all part of the story?
That's certainly part of the story, for sure. The martial spirit has evolved in different ways in different parts of the country. We have a whole chapter on Gallic warfare in the volume, looking at the continuing forms of conflict that pertained in the Highlands and Isles right up to the early 17th century. Again, there were other forms of conflict in the border regions, often between Scottish families as much as across borders, border reaving. And again, the history of the feud was very much etched in Scottish consciousness for long periods of time. And of course, the country very often suffered from that. There were socio-economic consequences of prolonged fighting in certain parts of the country. So there's a whole tradition of warfare going back in that way. And of course, more recently, of course, there were all the religious and ideological wars of the 17th and early 18th centuries, which again did a lot to forge the nature of the Scottish community that eventually evolved, and the dominance of the Kirk and all the rest. So, Scotland's had its share of belligerent experiences and has been, shaped accordingly.
Mm. And yet you were saying earlier that the part of the story, certainly in the medieval period, is battle avoidance and guerrilla tactics. So how does that feed into that story then? If the Scots were sort of notably martial in spirit, why were they keen to avoid fights?
Well, because they're up against a far larger and more powerful enemy. They had found that out when they faced the Romans. They certainly found that out when they faced Edward I, the Hammer of the Scots. When his invasion came, that was a real invasion, and Scotland suffered massively all the way up the Highlands under the power and the force of Edward I's armies. Very few armies resembled that the Scots thereafter had to face, and even those of his grandson Edward III, which easily routed the Scots whenever they faced them in battle, had the happy distraction of going off to fight in France. It was far more of a concern in the Hundred Years' War than dealing with their northern neighbours. So from the Scottish point of view, your raids and guerrilla warfare was an easier and more profitable option than engaging these much more powerful, cavalry-heavy armies that the English could put in the field and that the Scots would struggle to face. The Scots were often very numerous in battle, often had very large armies. They could muster the host, the common army, but they weren't necessarily very well equipped. They always had a shortage of siege engines, for example, for conducting major sieges. Those were expensive. They were draining on the morale and the commitment of some of those soldiers. And so they had very often had to take siege. They had to win sieges by stratagems, ruses, rather than simply bombarding down the walls and bludgeoning the inhabitants into surrender. So siege warfare was a critical thing, and all across the borders of Scotland and England, you still see today the relics of those castles, which were so prominent and critical for several centuries between the two countries.
So did the Scots see themselves as particularly ferocious warriors, say in the medieval period, in the 14th century, when when Edward I was coming up with his army? Did the Scots think of themselves as a match to the English soldiers? And what did the English soldiers think of the Scots? Did they see them as notable adversaries?
Well, it's interesting because there are relatively few Scottish sources on the Scottish period. There are one or two. I mean, the first source on Bannockburn is 70 years after the event. It's largely on basis of oral history. Blind Harry's writing on Wallace is a couple of hundred years after the event. So the Scots themselves don't have a great legacy of chronicles and things to work on. But the English chronicles do paint a picture of a very savage and belligerent adversary north of the border. Tales of mayhem being caused when some of these major raids are being conducted. The Pope eventually even has to intervene with the Scots at some time to try to persuade them to curb their ways in the way of their fighting, which seemed about 100 years behind the cultural norms that the Normans had brought in. They were still enslaving people long after the Normans had brought in, exchanging prisoners and that sort of respect, codes of chivalry. There was never a chivalrous order in Scotland, for example. So from an English perspective, these were really barbarians. And, they caused huge fear in the northern counties, Cumberland, Cumbria rather than Northumberland, and even down into Yorkshire and Lancashire. We have Scarborough being attacked, York, of course, all across the northern counties suffered periodically from Scottish raids. And this persisted even after the Wars of Independence. If one looks at, we're coming up at the moment, the 500th anniversary of Flodden, it was part of a period of major Scottish incursions, most of which went wrong, into England. And some quite major battles were fought in that period. Flodden, which was a huge defeat for the Scots. King James IV was killed. Solway Moss was a huge Scottish army, was routed just south of the border. And then the last major battle between the two countries at Pinkie-Cleugh on the Firth of Forth, that was another complete disaster for the Scots in 1547. So for all their belligerence, they weren't necessarily particularly successful. Where they were successful tended to be in the resilience, coping with disaster, refusing to accept occupation, and continuing to work sometimes with French allies, French aid, and certainly the capacity of English kings to be distracted by either problems internally or problems across the Channel.
Sure. So part of the perception of why in England, certainly, the Scots are seen as particularly ferocious warriors, must surely come from the fact that they were continually fighting against the English and then rebelling against the idea of a united kingdom, latterly. And I suppose the Jacobite story must be a big part of that, that must be a big player in why we think of the Scots as particularly...
Very much so. And although the Jacobites recruited all across Scotland, the final army in the 45 was known as the Highland Army. The clans were to the fore. The Highland Charge was still a very effective short-range battlefield tactic usually involved, you know, firing a volley first and then charging. And if the lay of the land was helpful, as it was at Killiecrankie, then you could overwhelm government troops relatively quickly. And it was a short, sharp, decisive tactic and a very ferocious thing to face. On the other hand, if they chose the ground badly, the troops were tired, and if the English had all their artillery in place, as they had, English and Scots had at Culloden, then the results could be utterly catastrophic. But it did take a while before Culloden occurred.
So is the story of Scottish military history skewed towards the Highlands because we tend to think of the soldiers as be-kilted and waving claymores and such like?
Well, it's more important even than that, because of course after the debacle at Culloden, which was as much a civil war in Scotland as it was an English-Scottish war, there was a period of romanticisation of the Highlands, which gets underway with Sir Walter Scott in a very big way, of talking about the lost cause of the Jacobites, not ever suggesting it could come back. But by romanticising the experiences of the Highlands, bringing back an acceptance of the Highlands as an integral part, indeed a revered part of Scotland. And of course, that was building on the readiness of Highlanders to serve in the British Army. Even ex-Jacobites join in huge numbers to fight in North America, in some cases, hopefully, trying to get their estates back from a grateful Hanoverian government. They fight in North America. They fight again, of course, in prodigious numbers in the French Napoleonic Wars, where the Scots are serving well above their proportion of the population, and particularly so from the Highlands. So the Highlands have made this huge effort, which Scott capitalizes on. And that very famous visit to Edinburgh of King George IV, the first Hanoverian monarch to visit Edinburgh. This is an extravaganza of tartan. All the great landowners are done up in tartans. They'll have to find tartans to appear. And it's clan nostalgia. This tartan extravaganza is put on for George IV. And this is one of the focal points of what's sometimes called the Highlandism of the Scottish soldier. And it becomes reinforced with the reforms of 1881, which not only preserve all the Highland regiments and restore the kilt in many cases to them, but also introduce elements of Highland dress to the Lowland regiments, which had never worn tartan trews or doublets or carried claymores before. But this had now become iconic of Scottish identity. And this is very much a tribute to the successes of the Highland soldiers. You think of Balaclava, the Thin Red Line. You think of them charging at Tel El Kebir. All sorts of battles in the Empire in which the Scots are to the fore. And this is partly, of course, propaganda by themselves, because they make sure they're posing for battle artists thereafter and advising them and on items of dress and deportment and all the rest. It's partly they've got a good story to tell. They are valiant soldiers, and they are very often used as storm troops in the Indian Mutiny, for example, as well as at the Crimea. So they've got a good story to tell. They make a point of telling it. And it's often said that one of the distinctive features of Scottish soldiering is how much they write about it as much as the fighting. And the way in which this is accepted in Victorian Britain, and particularly Victorian Scotland, as an icon of the Scottish identity, burgeoning Scottish identity within the Union.
Okay, you alluded to this just then, but what were the reasons why Scots came to serve in such great numbers and with such obviousness in the British and Imperial armies?
Well, the obviousness is evident by the fact that the British Army allows the Highland regiments to wear kilts, carry Highland weapons like claymores, have bagpipes, which are quite expensive, kidding people out. And they're distinctive, and so they're distinctive to friend and foe. And that distinctiveness comes its apogee at the Battle of Waterloo, where nearly all the paintings of Waterloo include Scots Highlanders somewhere. Even although arguably, you know, the Irish made as much of a contribution, if not more, than the Scots did. So there's no problem about their. You can't miss them. And for painters like Lady Butler, you know, this was marvellous. They were so pictorial, as she said. And so, you know, they were very much to the fore, you know, in khaki. When eventually the British Army's in khaki, the only thing that's colourful about a war print tends to be the kilt. And that sort of thing. So the image element is straightforward. In terms of actual serving, there are a number of factors. There's certainly not just volunteering for the sake of it. The Scots, certainly in the French and Revolutionary Wars and Napoleonic Wars, have a range of alternative military options. They can serve in the militia. They can serve in the local yeomanry. They can serve in fencibles, which are forces retained for home defence. They don't have to serve in the regular army. Some of them serve in the navy. 7% of Nelson's force at Trafalgar or something was Scots. So they have a lot of options. And the regular army isn't the only one. And of course, some Scottish regiments are so short of Scottish recruits, they have to recruit in England. Mm-hmm. And one of the features all the way through our book has been the recurrent dependence at times of Highland regiments on recruits from the industrial belt in Scotland and very often recruits from England and Ireland. And of course, in the modern day, you've got Fijians serving the Black Watch. So there is a recruiting shortfall there, where they're competing with the attractions of migration. They're competing with the attractions of better employment, where they can get it in Scotland and almost anywhere. Even the worst paid agricultural job in Caithness in the late 19th century is better paid than the regular army. So the army had its work cut out to recruit. And it must be said, in the late 19th century, when many of the magnates, you know, the Gordons and the Argylls and the like, were raising these regiments and were being paid healthily in terms of commissions and all the rest for doing so, there was elements of coercion. There were certainly, you know, tenants being forced to enlist, or else they're, you know, they might forfeit their tenanted estates. So you know, there was this sort of there are elements of compulsion here, even within a voluntary army. You know, that said, you know, there's a large number of Scots respond at this time, far larger than their proportion of the population, and that's particularly so in the Highlands. But, you know, that proportion can't be sustained over such a long military period. And it's interesting that by the early 19th century in the war, six Scottish regiments are required to abandon the kilt because it's thought to be a deterrent to recruiting in England.
Ah, right, okay.
So, many of those regiments spend the next 70 years campaigning to recover the kilt as a badge of Scottishness and identity, and most of them get it back, of course.
So, just moving the story on in conclusion, does that theme carry through into the 20th century and the global conflicts that Britain became involved in there?
Yes, it does. I mean, the Scots have a very significant role to play in both world wars, and it's a developing role. And one of the features of our book is we say that Scots adapt to warfare as warfare changes. There's a lot of Scottish women get engaged in war in the 20th century in all sorts of support occupations. Scotland becomes an ideal training ground, particularly north of the Great Glen, for all sorts of covert operations. The SOE, many of them are trained up there. Many of the commandos are trained up there in a big commando memorial in Spion Bridge. Scotland's also a key base for the Navy, Scapa Flow. It's a key base in the Second World War for the Royal Air Force, with a whole string of RAF bases all around the northern perimeter. And of course, those RAF bases have an even more daunting task in the Cold War, facing long-range bombers regularly patrolling over the UK from the Soviet Union. So, Scotland was very much at the frontier as a country in terms of defending the United Kingdom from northern threats. So in that sense, there's development. There's also a readiness to develop in different formations. A lot of the tradition in Scotland has been associated with regiments, Black Watch, Argyll and Southern Highlands and like. Well, in these two big wars, they're now fighting in brigades and divisions far more often. And you've got things like the 51st Highland Division, which is formed in the First World War and again in the Second World War. Four big Scottish divisions are actually forged in both wars, and the Scots developed their military identities in connection with larger formations, as well as the more famous smaller battalions. So that's another feature of development. And of course, you've got Scots involved in all sorts of other things too. The foundation of the SES is by a Scotsman. Much of Britain's military intelligence, you've had Scotsmen involved in it from their inception of the Special Intelligence Service. So, you know, the Scots, and indeed things like development of radar is done up in Dundee. So there's a whole range of things the Scots turn their hands to when they get chance in times of war. So this is part of the ongoing tradition that would occur. And come the Cold War, of course, you've then got the bases, the big submarine bases at Holyloke and Faz Lane, where the major part of the British deterrent is being based. I mean, it does arouse some local controversy, but nonetheless, this is another feature of Scotland's utility as a military base and a military training ground for all sorts of different purposes.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging, so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it, so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/HistoryExtra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/HistoryExtra.
So that was Edward Spears and the book A Military History of Scotland, edited by him, Jeremy Crang and Matthew Strickland, is published shortly by Edinburgh University Press. You can read a feature on this subject in the June issue of BBC History magazine, which is on sale now in the UK. Malcolm Chase is Professor of Social History at the University of Leeds. He's currently writing a book called 1820, Stress and Stability in the UK, which, as you can probably guess, is taking its focus on the single year, 1820. The first question I asked him was, why is 1820 in particular worth honing in on?
I think 1820 is fascinating for a number of reasons, not least because it raises quite acute questions about how the United Kingdom hangs together peacefully in a period of great political dislocation. Many people will be familiar with the Peterloo Massacre of August 1819 in Manchester, when the local yeomanry charged a demonstration and killed, well, there's a huge debate about the figures, but around 20 people, with about 450 or more, including women and children, seriously injured. And it's how Britain reacts to that, how the peace is kept, if you like, how political radicals and oppositional forces react to the measures that the government takes after Peterloo, some of them very repressive, that I think provide an interesting case study. There's a further dimension, though, which is that this is a year of European revolution. Everybody now thinks about the revolutions of 1848. But in 1820, there were revolutions in Spain, Portugal, Italy. The heir to the French throne was assassinated. There was a very real sense in the British government, one of whom, the Prime Minister, Lord Liverpool, had actually been present in 1789 in Paris when the Bastille was stormed. There was a very real sense in government that Britain might be on the brink of revolution.
And presumably the events of Peterloo and the year before would have augmented that view, would have magnified
absolutely.
That perception.
I mean, Peterloo is one of those events on which history turns. It becomes a great mobilising focus for radical politics. And it's still the case, even in the 1880s, that the last surviving people who'd been present at Waterloo were brought out for celebrations for the Third Reform Act in 1884. So it dominates the political landscape in Britain.
So is 1820 really all about 1819 then, and about the aftermath to that event in Manchester?
Not completely. And there's two reasons for that. One is because of the background of European revolution, which I've already mentioned. And the other is because of this extraordinary, unprecedented episode in 1820, when the new king, George IV, who's just come to the throne, having reigned as Prince Regent during the last years of George III. George IV's first act when he comes to the throne is to seek to divorce his wife, Queen Caroline. And the cause of Queen Caroline, a divorce being sought on the grounds of adultery, which is a bit rich coming from George IV, who never made any secret whatsoever about his mistresses and his own relaxed attitude to personal relationships. The cause of Queen Caroline becomes a huge popular campaign around which everybody rallies. Many women rally around her because they see her as the wrongly persecuted victim of male hypocrisy. Many political radicals come to her cause because while it may be risky to be campaigning for justice for the victims of Peterloo, campaigning for the rights of an aggrieved queen is, you know, can be presented as an act of patriotism. And many of the political opposition to the Tory government, members of the Whig Party, use this in effect as a political stalking horse to mobilise against a government which is actually pretty popular and on its own terms doing a good job.
Just on that George IV, he simply hated Caroline. Is that the only reason why he wanted to? He was.
Yes, when he was first, it was an arranged marriage, foisted on him by George III, in return for George III meeting his son's debts, which were considerable. On the first meeting, Caroline, he's supposed to have nearly fainted and called for brandy and smelling salts. He disliked her for a whole range of reasons: personal hygiene, appearance, lack of cultivation, sensibility, as he saw it. But I think most of all, he associated her with an episode in his life he wanted to forget, about being, you know, entirely, really, still the son of a father who was sort of Hanoverian, Germanic, disciplinarian. He felt manoeuvred into this marriage, and it wasn't something that he'd wanted. He had indeed already contracted an illegal marriage to Mrs. Fitzherbert before he married Caroline. So there were all manner of reasons why he wanted her out the way.
Okay. So what, in your view, was on the mind of the collective people in 1820? Were they focused on sort of the shock at what happened at Peterloo, on the drama of the divorce proceedings, or on the possibility of rebellion being exported from Europe? What was uppermost in the fears of the people?
I think, surveying the year briefly, what's uppermost initially are the repressive policies of the government, the so-called Six Acts, rushed through Parliament around Christmas time in 1819 to close down freedom of speech, assembly and publishing by radicals. Then there's a broader context that the winter of 1819-20 is one of the most severe on record, and this goes alongside, therefore, economic depression, high unemployment, suffering and want more generally. Then in March, the Spain and Portuguese revolutions come into play at almost the same time as the Cato Street conspiracy in London to assassinate the British cabinet collectively en bloc is exposed. And then just as the country is, as it were, taking stock of revolutions abroad and this sensational plot in London, you have two serious incidents of what are in effect uprisings around Easter in the West Riding of Yorkshire, centred on Huddersfield, and in Scotland, centred on the Clydeside area. Things quieten down somewhat after that for a couple of months, but then the Queen Caroline affair really comes into play when she returns to Britain in June, and divorce proceedings are immediately initiated in the House of Lords. Get to September and the whole of normal parliamentary government has ground to a halt. The House of Commons doesn't even sit between September and November, mid-November, except on one or two days. The whole of the political process grinds to a halt. It is easier, really, to identify places in, certainly in England and to a considerable extent in Britain as a whole, that don't have mass demonstrations in support of Queen Caroline, than it is to identify the places that do. It is an extraordinary event that seems to bring the whole country together in an almost carnivalesque expression of hostility to the current government.
So does it, in a strange way, all the drama and the interest in those divorce proceedings, in a strange way, sort of stave off the threat of a major social revolt because people have a focus on something that's not quite what they might have been focusing on before?
I think that's a valid interpretation. You could see the Caroline affair as a safety valve. It's very interesting that the popular demonstrations are most apt to become violent in those places where local authorities try to stop them. Where the local establishment just sort of step back and let things run their natural course, then very often there's little incidents of violence beyond the odd breaking of windows because people hadn't put lamps or candles in their windows to illuminate to show their support for the Queen. So yes, I mean, I think there is a sense in which it's a safety valve. It's also a severe test, however, of the government, which puts its political reputation on the line over the issue of supporting the King in his seeking the divorce case. And that hugely complicates, as it were, the political arithmetic around the House of Commons and the government's strength. Eventually, the government abandons the divorce bill, despite the protests of George IV, when it realises that it will never get a majority in the House of Commons in favour of a divorce. Had it pushed that point, the government would have been thrown out.
So does the year end with any more social harmony than when it began?
I'm inclined to the view that it does. I think that Caroline provides a rallying point around whom both established political opposition, the Whig Party, in other words, and extra-parliamentary radical forces can come together. And that is important in terms of lining up the parliamentary opposition with opposition to the government in the country. If you look at the situation at the beginning of 1820, it's not just the Tory Prime Minister Lord Liverpool and his supporters who are saying this country is on the cusp of revolution, we are facing a huge crisis, we cannot presume on the loyalty of the population. The Whig political opposition privately among themselves are saying the same thing, and they are no more confident of being able to carry the mood of the country with them than are the Tories. At the end of the year, the effect of Caroline is to bring extra parliamentary radicals into an uneasy alliance, but an alliance nonetheless with the Whig parliamentary opposition. Now, that has profound and important consequences for the history of Britain over the next 10 to 15 years, because it is that popular alliance of radicalism and Whiggism that secures the Great Reform Act in 1832 and arguably helps keep extra-parliamentary political activity in an age without democracy somewhat in check.
It's an interesting point. You've sort of moved the story on to talk about what happened after, but your book presumably will focus specifically on the year 1820. So is that a difficult thing for a historian to do, to focus? I mean, quite a few books have been written that are year specific in the last few years. It seems like a trend for people to do it. But does that mean that it makes it more difficult for you to do what a historian, you know, is naturally trained to do, to look at the long story?
Yes, it is a challenge, and I hated writing my conclusion. I really found it difficult. History is untidy, it doesn't come neatly packaged, and there's a certain degree of artifice involved in creating a neat ending to a book when it's a completely arbitrary chronological point. And in fact, I didn't do it, I have to be honest. In my conclusion, I looked ahead to one or two points of longer term significance, like the popularity of the Whig Party. But my epilogue actually is the coronation of George IV, which takes place the following summer in 1821, when there is the, on the face of it, very dangerous moment when Queen Caroline turns up at Westminster Abbey for the coronation and is rejected and refused admission. Does this then lead to popular revolt, to Whig politicians storming out of the coronation in her support? No. She's completely marginalised and isolated. And one of the challenges that I've tried to answer in the book is to explain why that should have changed, how the situation of this woman over the space of a mere 7 months could have so dramatically altered, and what are the processes underpinning that.
Going against my last question, I can think of lots of years in around your period of expertise that might be seen as sort of pivotal, important years. 1832, you've already mentioned, maybe 1789, obviously, is quite important, maybe 1807 for slavery and such like. 1820 perhaps doesn't often get cited in lists of important years. Should it be in a list of important years?
Yes, I think it should. I think the European revolutionary dimension is important. Although we put a lot of emphasis on Peterloo in 1819, it's what happens afterwards that really needs explaining and teasing out. And I don't think anybody's ever sat down, totted up the pages, but if I was a betting man, I'd be prepared to wager that more attention has been paid to Queen Caroline and the divorce case than almost any other episode in early 19th century British history. And the danger, one of the real reasons why I decided to write the book, was that I thought we were missing the bigger picture in 1820. But also we weren't understanding the importance of the Caroline affair either, because we were seeing, as it were, in isolation from the broader context. So no, 1820 definitely, well, I would say this, wouldn't I? But I do think that 1820 raises in a particular acute form some of the key issues about the nature of early 19th century society, as well as encompassing within its 12 months some episodes of very striking, uniqueness in many instances. It's the only occasion before the 20th century in which there's been any question around a royal divorce case. It's the only occasion on which there's been an attempt to assassinate the entire cabinet. You know, Spencer Perceval, the Prime Minister, was assassinated in 1812 by a lone gunman who was mentally deranged. The plot to assassinate the whole cabinet is an extraordinary episode. Or those Easter risings that I referred to. You know, some people talk about the Scottish uprising of 1820. It's a pivotal moment in the evolution of Scottish national identity. I haven't even mentioned here what's going on in Ireland. It's a year of in which British authority in Ireland is severely challenged in the West by the Ribbon Movement, as so-called. So there's a great deal going on, and what is going on is raising, I think, the very interesting and important questions about British society in the early 19th century generally.
What we need to know is how close you think Britain was in 1820 to having a revolution, how close it was to society breaking down.
Well, despite all I've said to the effect that this is an extraordinary year, I think ultimately Britain doesn't come that close. In some ways, the challenge to me as a historian of this 12-month period is actually to examine the conditions of stability, what it is that holds society together. I think it's of pivotal importance that the parliamentary opposition, the Whigs, which starts the year almost as lacking in popular support as the government, manages to achieve a considerable degree of popularity by the end of it. I think it's important also to point to the way in which, whilst central government is deeply unpopular, loathed in fact by many people, the local state, local establishments, local authority manages to hold society together at the micro level. It's very striking that a succession of small reforms that don't really get noticed in the textbooks around 1820 mark a quite significant step forward in the nature of local government. And those reforms have the effect of bringing in people who are outside of the political establishment into the process of government. I think that's a key consideration.
OK, last question, just to conclude. I think our listeners would want to know. We talked about Caroline and what happened to her in 1820, and you've issued a challenge to people to count up the number of references to her, which I hope our podcast listeners will take up. But what happens to Caroline in the end? Does she end up in a terrible state?
It's a very poignant story. She is ejected from... Well, she's not ejected. She's not even allowed into Westminster Abbey. And within 12 weeks, she's died. The popular view was that she'd died of a broken heart. The last big demonstration in her support is around the issue of what route her coffin should take through the capital. She lived in Hammersmith in West London, and the government was rather hoping that en route to Harwich, because she was going back to her German homeland to be buried, the government was rather hoping that the funeral cortege would take a circuitous route round London that would keep it out of all the trouble spots. And her radical supporters put up one last show of defiance, really, to ensure that her coffin is escorted with full pomp and ceremony through the middle of the city. And she is died and is practically forgotten thereafter until she's rediscovered, in effect, in the mid-20th century, by historians who like the look of a feisty woman, capable apparently of almost destabilising a government and driving a male monarch to distraction.
That was Malcolm Chase of the University of Leeds. Look out for his book on 1820, which will hopefully be published in the next year or so. That's your lot for this week. Next time round, we will be considering the reigns of two queens, Elizabeth I and Elizabeth II. In the meantime, do take a look at our website, historyextra.com, for blogs, quizzes, galleries, and a whole lot more. Plus, remember, we're on digital formats. Kindle and iPad can be found on the Amazon and Apple newsstand sites. And if you don't like that, then you can, of course, still buy the printed product. The History Extra weekly podcast is recorded in Bristol and produced by Dave Gibson.